look at me. I'm wearing a suit, approximately like my dad's. And you'll see, suspenders to boot, my dad's up on the latest fads. We're like two peas in a pod, so don't think it odd if I should go out on a limb and say when I grow up, I'm gonna be just like him.
I need coffee.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, October 30th, 2011. My name is James Marino, and on the call this morning, we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter can be found at the New York Star Ledger, where he writes for them at all days of the week. He writes for Masterworks Broadway on Thursdays, and he writes for Kritzerland on Fridays. He also has a new book out that you should check out, Broadway Musical MVPs, 1960 to 2010, The Most Valuable Players of the Past 50 Seasons. Good morning, Peter.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a writer and photographer. You can see his writing and photography at BroadwayStars.com. You can see his photography at FollowSpotPhoto.com. He also writes for the Sondheim Review. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, everybody.
We also have two special guests with us, Matt Sklar and Chad Beglin. They are Broadway writers, as you know. And they're here to talk to us this morning about a new release of their CD of the Broadway musical Elf. Good morning, guys. How are you doing?
Very well. Thanks for having us.
Okay, you need to identify who is who. So, Matt, say hello.
Hello, this is Matt.
And Chad, say hello.
Hey, how are you doing?
Great, thanks. That's my fault. I'm sorry about that. I should have realized that. Nobody would know who's talking. So tell us, you have a recording of last season's Broadway show, Elf, coming out. Tell us about that process. And you guys recorded this last February, was it?
We recorded it after the show had closed last year. So I believe we did it in January, wrangling the cast together after we closed. And we actually did it in two different sessions because everybody had gone away because the show had closed. So we kind of had to do a little work on some logistics, get everybody together. So we had the orchestra and the principals on the first day, and then we had the ensemble come in the second day, and we just had a blast recording the show.
I've recorded a few shows, a few recordings in my time. Mm-hmm. 2 days, it seems like that's crazy to get so much music and everything down in 2 days. Was it like a fire drill?
It is a marathon. I think we got to the studio at about 9 in the morning, and we were leaving at around midnight. It was a long day, but we got everything done, and everybody was on their game, and we had a blast.
Great, and there's a bit of time in between closing night and recording, and you did it in a different environment. How is it working out with getting the right sound down that you want to get down, or replicating what you did on the stage?
The actors were really great at, it was sort of like a lot of them said, it's like riding a bike. They were, it was a few weeks since they had done it, but, it was in their body. So a lot of it was muscle memory, and they really stepped up.
That's great.
I have a question. As we all know, in the old days, the tradition was that every Broadway cast album would be recorded on the Sunday right after the opening, because in those days there were no Sunday shows. Mm-hmm. And they would be done in a huge marathon session, however long it took. Famously, there's the documentary of the Company cast album. But in this case, since the show was already closed, was it still compressed? Because is it cheaper just to have fewer days there, more time on fewer days? Or was it, I suppose it has something to do with the fact of just the availability of the cast.
Well, it's actually very much an economic decision. The Actors' Equity rule is that for every day that you record with the cast, they get a week's salary. So if you were to spread it over 2 days, they'd get 2 weeks, and then the cost would spiral out of control. So that's actually very much the reason why you do it in one day.
Isn't there an equity rule that if you close the show and you do it a certain number of weeks later, that you don't fall under that 1 week rule?
I believe it's 9 or 10 months later, though.
Is it 9 or 10 months?
And we wanted to get the cast sure. really fresh and get everybody together and capture those performances.
Yeah. I had a question for you, and it's eluded me. Peter, did you listen to this album yet?
No, I don't have it, but I will say that what disappoints me tremendously is we're not going to have Elf with us this Christmas season, and for that matter, I don't see any reason why we can't have Elf every day of the year. Back in 1963, there was a musical version of Miracle on 34th Street that opened in October and ran till July. And believe me, if it was any good, it would have run longer. It was a terrible musical version of that property. And when you watch the movie, the song cues just jump out at you and say, oh, why didn't they musicalize that? Why didn't they musicalize this? And perhaps they did. They threw it out in rehearsal or out of town. But nevertheless, it really was atrocious. And if a Christmas show could run for that many months and be no good, why can't Elf be around all the time? Because it's such a fabulous story. It's a lovely, lovely time. And, you know, also we're in an era where I'm sure kids are watching Christmas movies all times of the year, DVDs, or even if you remember the term videotapes, I'm sure they watch them. So, I mean, really, what is the problem? I vote that Elf be with us at all times because I thought it was terrific.
Well, on that note, Peter, I was just talking with Randy Skinner, who choreographed White Christmas, and he said that show's being done all over and not necessarily only at Christmas.
So
you may see Elf popping up in, you know, March somewhere.
We saw a big promo for White Christmas yesterday across the tri-state area.
Mm. Paper Mill is doing it in a couple of weeks, you know, and one must admit that they're doing it at Christmas season. But this is such a lovely story. And, what really impressed me, too, was the fact that at one point there was a song called Just Like Him. Mm-hmm. I guess, right? That's what it's called?
Yeah.
Am I right? I mean, I'm going back, you know, some time ago. And as I say, I don't have the album. But Buddy gets so exuberant that he runs over to one of his father's employees, hugs him tight, and lifts him off the ground. And the employee says, I already have a boyfriend. And I thought that was sensational because many of us remember a time when the employee would have reacted in horror. He would have given him a startled look, said, you're crazy, or a disgusted look that said, you should pardon the expression, you're queer, before he would have run off in horror. So, and such a situation would have passed for humor back then, you know. So, and the audience would have laughed at the plight of a heterosexual man having to endure the affection of an ostensibly gay man, you know. But thank heavens times have changed. I mean, that's what I loved about Elf. It was smart. It was right now. It was up to date. You know, I hate that I'm using the past tense that Elf was. Are there any plans to bring it back? This should be at least an annual event. This must have been discussed this year. And tell us about that.
Yeah, well, this year we we were planning to come back, but it was really a real estate issue.
It always is.
Not yet, you know, it has to be in a theater that, you know, has enough seats that makes, you know, financial sense.
Oh, sure. And it was a very elaborate production,
And it's really, it's always a nail biter every year because, you know, what theater will be open, what theater, and we have to know so far in advance.
Yeah.
It's hard because, you know, the stars have to align. So, and this year they're just, good for the theater business, you know, the theaters that would have made sense were booked. So, you know, every year, I think around, probably June or July, Matt and I start sweating. So,
yes,
I understand. Yeah. And really what a shame that, all those theaters that existed, in the first half of the, 20th century, were torn down because everybody thought, oh, we don't need them anymore, you know, and now apparently
right.
we do because shows run longer, you know, so it's really very sad.
Yeah. Guys, when you recorded it, did you use the same size orchestra that you used during the show?
It's the exact same size orchestra.
And did you make any updates or changes to, you know, a lyric here, a lyric there, or a phrasing, or cut some dance music, or how did you?
We actually wanted to. I love David Chase's dance music, so I actually wanted to record as much as possible. I used to get frustrated when I would listen to cast albums as a kid and know that there was a big giant cut in the middle of a song.
Yeah.
So I actually voted to have as much of it as possible, and I don't think there's very many cuts at all Just, you know, a stop time here or there because we didn't have the, we couldn't use the props in Just Like Him because there's lots of, you know, banging pencils on desks and that wouldn't read on a recording. So, like, I think we trimmed those bars. But otherwise, I think pretty much the entire score is represented on the album.
Well, I do have the album. I got it the other night. I listened to the whole thing last night, and it's terrific.
Great.
As I know Peter agrees and everyone else I know, these guys, they can write insanely catchy songs. And there's at least one of them. Well, there are several, but there's one that's just not going to get out of your head, and it's called Sparkle Jolly Twinkle Jingly. And I really love that. And I also, you know what I love is that Sebastian Arcelus was given the opportunity to give such a wonderful, endearing performance as Buddy. Because prior to that, he certainly is not a household name. And but he really, just really was terrific. And Beth Level, you know, one of the best ever. And Mark Jacoby, one of my favorites. It was, you know, a fantastic cast and a great score. And I think it really, as Peter said, it's a very smart show. And it's, you know, it can be very difficult to kind of walk that line between sentiment and humor and intelligence. But I think it does it perfectly. And it's a wonderful album. I'm going to be listening to it a lot. I know that.
Okay. Michael, I don't know if you remember this, Michael, but when we went to the press preview of The Wedding Singer, we were coming down the elevator at that studio on 42nd Street and saying, yes. Wow, that It's Your Wedding Day song, that is so catchy. I remember that so vividly, you and I discussing that and saying, that's a good song. And you've certainly had success with that. I mean, I've seen Wedding Singer here, there, and everywhere. It was just nice that even my son out in San Jose recently saw it, so nice things to say. So it's nice that we still have that around too.
I'd love to hear that.
So tell us what is happening in your lives outside of Elf. Matt, why don't you tell us what you're up to these days?
Well, we're in the beginning stages of writing two new musicals, not based on movies. They're both original ideas. They're both in very early days, so kind of concentrating on those right now. It's kind of what's been going on. I wish I could elaborate more, but I'm still figuring out what
they
are.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Chad, what about you?
I'm spending a lot of time doing sort of pole dancing and
me too.
Oh my God. I knew.
I thought I saw you there. Yeah.
We're sort of starting, very early days with a couple of projects. So we're exploring where they'll go. It's really fun to do an adaptation, but it's also fun to sort of, start from scratch, which is daunting and exciting. So we'll see where we end up.
So let's rehash stuff that might have been talked about last year before Elf opened. Tell us about your introduction to the project and how you guys got involved with it. Was it something that you brought to somebody else, or did somebody come to you?
We were in the process of doing Wedding Singer, and Matt, was it at the opening night?
It was during, I believe it was during, right before we opened Wedding Singer. One of the producers, Mark Kaufman, he asked us to go to dinner with him before the performance, and basically just asked us because it was one of their properties. And he said they've been looking at making a stage adaptation of Elf, and would we be interested in it? Because we had such a wonderful time working with them on Wedding Singer.
So is it intimidating to take on these very popular star-driven movies that and adapt it for the stage, knowing that you're not going to have an Adam Sandler or a... I'm blank. Will Ferrell come in to do this? What's your mindset there? You ever hesitant to take on a project like that?
Well, I think we've been extremely lucky because with Wedding Singer we had Stephen Lynch, and with Elf we had Sebastian. So they both brought their own personalities and their own sort of take on the roles, which has been a huge boon to the process, because they came in, I have to say speaking of Sebastian, he was the last person we saw when we were auditioning. And
wow.
We were down, it was right before he came in, and I had just seen him in Happiness, and I thought of him as a very, you know, serious actor who could, you know, never, you know, I thought he was, you know, Hamlet. So, you know, I said, oh God, you know, we were all like, we have to see more people. And then he came in and blew us away. So when you have, you know, somebody like Sebastian come in and have such a clear take on the role, which is completely different from Will Ferrell, it just makes it so much easier because he came in, he owned it, and he made it his own. So in a way, we started writing to his strengths because he was so clear on who he thought Buddy should be.
So, Matt, let me ask you first, and I'll ask Chad after this. Before you were big, huge Broadway stars, as we say. What was your who was inspiring for you? Who did you listen to and say, oh, I have to go see so and so's work to get inspired, whether it be another writer or director or actor or anybody like that? Matt, tell us first.
I was fortunate enough to grow up right in New Jersey, right near the Peyton Row Playhouse, where my family had a subscription. So I regularly went to the theater. I would say once a month, my parents would say, all right, we're going to see a matinee, and we'd get in the car. And we'd go, and I think we probably wore out the cassettes to A Chorus Line, Annie, They're Playing Our Song, Fiddler on the Roof. I grew up with those musicals ingrained in my head. So I always, you know, I love Charles Strauss and Cy Coleman and, you know, and Jerry Herman. And I love those guys. And just to me, I just really want to write a good tune. That's really what's important to me.
Chad?
When I was, I think, about 14, my dad said, you know, do you want to come with me to New York? And I was, of course, thrilled. And we saw at, I think it was the Orpheum Theater, the off-Broadway production of Little Shop of Horrors. And I fell in love with Howard Ashman right then. It's the first time I ever really listened to lyrics, and by the time he rhymed tawdry with Audrey, it was the rhyme I didn't know I was waiting for the entire show. And I just remember being just so blown away, and just the lyrics were so amazing. So I think that's when I said, okay, if I can't write them, I at least want to be around them. So I think Howard Ashman for me is just the, you know, everything. He's just the pinnacle of lyric writing. And I of course have to say Sondheim, but I really love Howard Ashman's work, and it just really inspired me when I was, you know, a kid.
Something
what
that
a shame we lost him so young. I mean, it was really such a shame. I mean, I, by the way, was also a great fan, much more than Marvin Hamlisch, believe me, of Smile. I thought his work for Smile was excellent. Mm. And a lot of people say, oh, Smile isn't as good as the movie. Frankly, I think the Smile musical is better than the movie in many respects. Mm. And and I'm sorry it didn't have more of a life, though it does get done here and there. Yeah,
well, so. if you can listen to Disneyland and not cry, I don't know who you are.
Well, you don't want to know who we are, right?
Exactly.
So you two bring up something that we've talked about on the podcast a bunch of times in the past, is that it's a parent's responsibility to take their children to theater.
I agree.
Because if the parents had never taken you guys to the theater, who knows where you'd be? You'd probably be a pole dancer somewhere.
<You know? laughs>
not that there's anything wrong with that.
Way to bring it back.
Anything wrong with that. Chad, Matt, what's the first project you guys worked on together, and how did you guys get together?
Well, this is Chad. I sent a musical that I wrote to Musical Theater Works, which doesn't exist anymore, but was a great place for writers. And the literary manager, Andrew Barrett, sent me a rejection letter saying, no thanks. And I actually sent him a letter saying, I'd love to take you out to lunch and talk and just get your views on what works and what doesn't work. And so we met, and he said, listen, I know this guy, Matt Sklar. And Matt was, you were doing Godspell, right?
I was music directing an undergrad production of Godspell at NYU when I think I guess I was a sophomore there. And it was in the fall, and you know, when you do Godspell, you know, we updated some of the arrangements. You know, I did some of some vocal arrangements, and Andrew came and found me after the show and said, "Do you want to write musicals?" And I said, "Yes, that's what I want to do with my life. I just don't have anybody to write with." And he said, "Give me your phone number. I think I have the guy." And Chad and I met at the old, it was the Astoria Diner on Astor Place, right near the Public. Yeah. And that's now a Starbucks. And we just sort of hit it off and started talking about ideas right away. And the great thing about Musical Theater Works is that they had a slot for us, you know, for a reading series that they were doing that they didn't have anything for. And we had just met, and they said, if you can write something, I think it was probably October, they said, if you can have something ready for February, we'll do it. And we were too young to realize you're not supposed to be able to do that. So we wrote a show in about 8 weeks and got to see it a month later.
Wow. That's great.
Andrew is a friend of mine, and he once said to me that he hooked you up, and so I'm delighted to hear you give him credit for that. It's really nice, because I can't tell you how many people I interview who don't give credit to the people who brought them together. So I'm very proud of both of you for bringing that up. So that's very nice.
You probably don't realize that I introduced Andrew Lloyd Webber to Tim Rice.
Yes.
So, yeah.
You're right.
It's very overlooked. It's, I get very upset.
You should reintroduce them.
Good for you.
Touché. Well, Chad and Matt, thank you so much for taking time out of your Sunday morning, which is no man's land for most theater people. Sunday morning to come talk with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. You guys have a great day.
You too.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, guys.
Right. And we'll have our pictures taken for the Christmas cards we're making. Him and me in suits of matching plaid. And when people see us walking, they'll be Google-eyed and gawking at Buddy and the world's greatest dad.
Good luck, Buddy. Hope you find your dad.
Thanks, Mr. Narwhal. We'll spend mornings holding hands and making plans on whether to play jacks or kick the can. Then for lunch a ginger snap, then a nap to fill the gap between building forts and playing Superman. And if his back gives him a spasm, well, every good dad has him. I'll bring him cocoa and a heating pad. It's a scene inside a snow globe, it's a very apropos globe. Just Buddy and the world's greatest dad.
All right, so that was Chad and Matt from Elf. And my apologies, Peter, I thought that that you had the CD already, or I would have gotten it to you. I will get you a copy of it.
Oh, thank you.
Sure. Absolutely. So moving on, Peter and Michael got to go see We Live Here. So Peter, why don't you start us off with that?
Zoe Kazan, who's best known as an actress and has been in a number of shows, some people have liked her very much, some have not, has now written a play, which some people will like very much and some will not. It's a family drama. It's an exciting time in this family's life because of the three sisters we are meeting. One is getting married. However, there is a problem because one of the other sisters is now dating a boy that the third sister used to date, and it didn't work out well, and as a result, the sister even committed suicide. I guess I'm giving away too much, and I'm sorry that I am. But nevertheless, what's fascinating to me is that here we are dealing with a guy who will, before all is said and done, have a relationship with all three sisters. And so it's a messy show in that sense, and it's messy in many ways. But nevertheless, I was sitting there. It was one of those shows where I'm sitting there and saying, you know, should I really stay for the second act? You know, I think I should, because I'm intrigued enough to see how this is all going to play out. And so it did hold my attention to that degree. I have to stay anyway, frankly, I will admit. But I'm talking really about whether or not my mind would be engaged for the second act. Would I tune out and start thinking of what I have to do that week? Sometimes that does happen to me if I'm really bored with the play. But this one did hold my attention to the degree that I wanted to see how it all played out. I'm not saying it played out terribly satisfactorily. terribly. I'm not saying it played out terribly believably to me, but nevertheless, there was something about this that was intriguing. What I also have to say is we must remember that Zoe Kazan is first and foremost an actress. And if this is her hobby, sideline, well, good for her. She did it. She started it. She continued it. She finished it. She got it on. I mean, granted, I know she must have some lovely connections from working in the theater on a very regular basis. But nevertheless, people say no. Sometimes people pigeonhole you and say, no, Zoe, you're an actress. Stay with acting, will you please? You know, and that didn't happen here. So she got a good deal of attention. And it's very nicely done. I certainly enjoyed seeing Amy Irving playing the mother. Seems like only yesterday she was the kid in Carrie. To me, but nevertheless, the movie, not the musical. And but there she is, you know, all grown up and playing a mother and playing a very ditzy type of mother that reminded me very much of my former mother-in-law. So I really enjoyed her performance. I also liked Jeremy Shamos as the groom-to-be. I thought he was terrific, too. There is an issue because it's not very well developed, but there is an issue that at least the mother thinks that he may very well be gay. This is dropped in, it's dropped out, it's dropped back in again, and then you don't hear about it again, but there it seems like something that she may have had much more in the script, and she was encouraged to take it out because it seems to come out of nowhere, leave out of nowhere, and come back out of nowhere again. but I liked the way he played his character very much. So I do think that the girl who plays the youngest sister, who is in her first year of college, I'm not going to give her name, I don't want to embarrass her. It's not that she's giving a bad performance, but I thought she was much too old. I had, when it came out that she was a teenager in her first year of college, I was stunned. I really was expecting to hear about, well, she took, you know, 10 years off to see the world and then went back to college because she really seemed much too old. This, again, this is casting to me, not of course the director approved her, you know, but nevertheless, that was something that took me by surprise when it came out that she was a teenager. So yeah, good things, bad things. Not a must see by any means, but if you already have tickets and you're consigned to go, I say don't give the tickets away. Go have this nice experience of seeing what an actress is able to accomplish as a writer. And it's on a scale from 0 to 10, maybe a 5, maybe a 6, maybe a 6.3. So you know, certainly had real playwrights who do nothing but write plays, do far worse than that. So at least to that degree, congratulations.
Michael, what did you think?
Yeah, the thing about the connections, Zoe Kazan is also the granddaughter of Yulia Kazan, and her parents were writers, I believe, at least one of them. And so one could look at it in, you know, anyone who fears nepotism or, well, that's not even the right word, just anyone who says, well, you know, it's all about connections and blah, 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 could look at this in two ways. On the one hand, I really don't think it's certainly not a polished, very accomplished work. And one might argue that it probably wouldn't have been produced and certainly not on this level if she wasn't who she is in terms of her name, and also her previous, you know, notoriety as an actress. But on the other hand, as is also the case with Asuncion by Jesse Eisenberg, which we're going to discuss next, I was very impressed that there was so much good about both plays. And specifically in terms of dialogue, I guess it's not surprising that two actors would write such excellent dialogue, such excellent believable, playable dialogue. But of course, the fact that you're an actor doesn't necessarily mean you can do that. But both of these people can, I think. That was not a flaw of either play. I just think it, you know, there are other aspects of them. There are some very over-the-top things that happen in We Live Here, and I don't think that she handled them nearly as well as, you know, she might have if she had more experience. And ultimately, it was very, I found it very not satisfying. I didn't feel like the audience was terribly with it at the end. You know, there were places when they were with it, and then there were places when they were not. That's just the feeling I had. And I don't know if, you know, when you write, of course, every play is heightened reality to an extent. There's no play that's just a documentary thing. But I think perhaps if both writers had chosen to write things that maybe were not so out there in terms of some of the plot elements and some of the characters, that there might have been better choice for their first efforts, or one of their first efforts, because that to me was the issue here. But I also agree, great production. Jeremy, I'm glad you singled out Jeremy Shamos, Peter, because I've really enjoyed him in several things. But I think this is the first thing I've seen him in that wasn't entirely comic, and it was very. I was very happy to see that he has the dramatic chops as well. And yes, it was Oscar Isaac, who's done a lot of good work, including Romeo in the Park a few years ago with Lauren Ambrose, was very good in one of those roles that have a lot below the surface to them. And yes, I enjoyed the whole cast. Betty Gilpin, who I had seen in a reading of Butterflies Are Free a year or two ago with Jonathan Groff up at the Westport Country Playhouse, was in it, and I was glad to see her on stage in New York. So yeah, that's what I think. Would you agree, Peter, at least about the dialogue part? Because I was very impressed with that.
Sure. It did have its potboiler elements as a plot, but yes, there was very little that hit my ear in the dialogue. And we were saying, people wouldn't say that. No, that's that's wrong for that character. That's the writer giving her own voice, whether the character needs it or not. So, no, I didn't have that experience at all.
And that is a great talent, because there are many people who can. I mean, you know, I think O'Neill couldn't do that. You know, so that is not to be sniffed at, that talent. It's just that, I think they both need to work on the other aspects and maybe try a different. You know, maybe the next play could be a little more. What's the word? Just the things that happen in this are a lot of them are like really, really like crazy. And it's hard to write that obviously. So I think maybe for the next one, maybe something a little bit more, I don't want to say true to life. What do I want to, not so out there, not so very, very heightened reality.
Mm-hmm.
All right. One of the things that I wanted to point out is that this is at Manhattan Theater Club at their City Center Stage 1. And MCC runs this great 30 Under 30 program where you can go and sign up for free if you are under 30 years old and get $30 tickets. So it's at $30, well worth going to go see at least what we've talked about here. Next up on the list is Jesse Eisenberg in a play at the Cherry Lane Theater called, let me see if I get it correctly, Asuncion. Is that correct? Or did I get it right, Michael? Close?
Yeah, I think that's very close. Maybe Asuncion.
Asuncion.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So, Michael, why don't you tell us about this?
Well, again, you know, as I said, his dialogue is, Jesse also wrote the play. The dialogue, I think, is very well written. It seems entirely natural. It doesn't seem in any way unbelievable. But again, the situation here, I don't even, I'll try to do it. He plays a recent college grad, and he's living with his former TA in Black Studies. And they have a very odd relationship, which is never fully explained as far as exactly what, if there is any homoeroticism going on there or not. There's one moment when it really comes to the fore and you say, well, what exactly is going on here? And on the one hand, I certainly don't think that everything needs to be explained in a play. I mean, we certainly don't want that necessarily. But on the other hand, if you're so confused about what's going on and what exactly is happening between two characters, I think it can sort of take you out of what's happening. So I felt a little bit of that. And then this very odd situation he sets up where Jesse's character's brother, played by Remy Auberjonois, arrives with his wife, Asuncion, who is Filipino, and he leaves her with them for an unexplained reason. He says that she can't be at their home for a while. And there again, it's like they don't press him for a reason. And it's like, well, you keep thinking, well, wouldn't they demand to know? You know, wouldn't they really, you know, would they just accept being told, well, I'll tell you later? It didn't kind of ring true to me. But anyway, so she's placed in this situation and she's living with him and she's living with Edgar, that's the Jesse Eisenberg character, and Vinny, his former TA, played by Justin Bartha. And by the way, Asuncion is played by Camille Mana. So that's it. It's a four-person cast. And it's all about how the play is, as others have pointed out, somewhat Pinterest-esque in some ways, in the terms of the relationships of these two guys and this woman and exactly what's going on and who might be sexually attracted to whom and what kind of power structure is set up in this ratty little apartment in Binghamton, New York. And a lot of it is very interesting, but also it just seemed like there were a lot of unanswered questions and too many unanswered questions. And just again, some plot elements that just seemed like so strange that they were distracting sometimes more than interesting. So that's what I felt. But again, very, very promising work from Jesse Eisenberg, who also, I hasten to add, is just as compelling and charming and funny and adorable on stage as he is on screen. I was struck when watching this that he must have gotten along really, really well with Aaron Sorkin when they did The Social Network, because especially in the comedic portions, the dialogue is very similar. This especially for his character, Jesse's character, this rapid fire kind of young intellectual banter that can be extremely funny when it's well done. It's unbelievable how fast he talks in some sections of this play, but you get every word, and it's a good theater for it, the Cherry Lane. It's intimate. So that was a good choice as far as the venue. I very, very interesting, very promising, I would say.
Peter, what did you think?
I was very intrigued by this play, even though I agree entirely that it's a very strange thing that when the brother leaves off the wife with the brother, he doesn't say why. When we find out later the reason, it isn't even a particularly good reason. No. And it's also a reason that there would be no need not to give it right at the top of the play, except that we need to keep that suspense going, because here's what's going on here. The young wife is from the Philippine Islands. They got married quickly, and Edgar, Jesse Eisenberg character, believes that there's something funny going on here, that perhaps his brother has ordered a mail order bride who has been used as a sex slave in the Philippine Islands, that he starts talking about all the bad things that happened in that part of the world. Now, what's interesting here is the fact that he is quite the liberal. He also talks quite a bit about spending time in Cambodia and seeing what was going on there. We later learned he was in Cambodia for 2 days, no time at all, you know, and he makes this like his badge of honor that I've been to Cambodia and I know what's going on and that type. So the point is that liberal that he is, he turns out to be not so liberal when it comes to giving people the benefit of the doubt, especially people from a foreign land. So that's what this play is truly about. This is about a guy who really lords it over everybody, that he has his finger on the pulse of what is good about humanity, and yet when the time comes to give any type of, when he really has to make a decision about who people really are, he will not even consider another side of the story, that he's got it locked into his head that something terrible is going on here. Now, one could effectively argue that given that the brother didn't give him a reason, he's entitled to have a doubt, but his mind does run rampant on this. Now, the girl, the new young wife, is sunny and adorable and is up for America and has all these bubbly values. And point is, he's still waiting for a chink in the armor. He's still waiting for something to show up to indicate that she is different from what she pretends to be. And again, this is what this play is about, not giving the benefit of the doubt, that we're not as liberal as we think we are, no matter how liberal we are. by the way, about the thing with the two guys living together, yes, there's no question at the beginning of the play we are we're assuming that they're lovers, especially the fact that one was the TA and one was the student. The world is littered with relationships between TAs and students, and teachers and students and professors and students and what have you. So, but this is interesting too, because we are making an assumption as well. assumption, by the way, is a translation of assumption, and I think that name was chosen for that reason. But we're making the assumption these guys have to be lovers, and as time goes on, it was very clear to me they are roommates, especially when Vinny is asking, "You are behind on the rent." You know, I mean, you can really tell by the incessant things about "you owe me money, get it up," you know, so on and so forth, that we are talking about a roommate situation. But again, I think the reason that it's we're just led to believe two guys living together in an apartment, one of whom is older, one of whom is that type of hero worship, and Jesse Eisenberg does that rather well. For those who have seen The Social Network, it's really something to see this other side of this actor, because he is playing, as Michael said, a fast-talking, not in the Harold Hill sense, but just somebody who is nervous. It's very Woody Allen-ish in the old days. This guy could do a production to play it against Sam in a second. But that's the type of character he is. He's nervous. He's upset. He has no self-confidence. Life isn't going his way, and he knows it. And he's beaten down by it. He hasn't had a relationship with a woman for a good long time, and or a bad long time, and so it's something. I did see The Social Network, and there, of course, he was playing this imperious guy who certainly is, as he pointed out, you know, I could buy this entire building that we're in right now. I could buy all of Mount Auburn Street, you know, there's none of that in this character, none whatsoever. So it was nice to see that. It's nice to see that he wanted to write a character that was very different from the character that he was. I was more entertained by this than I was by We Live Here. It's easier to be entertained by this than We Live Here. It's a natively more funny play. And seeing the junky apartment, and it's almost Neil Simon-esque that in the second act the apartment is spruced up a bit. You know, I mean, think how many Neil Simon plays did that. The apartment is a mess, and then the next time the curtain goes up, it's lovely. It happened in Barefoot in the Park. It happened after Felix cleaned up Oscar's apartment in The Odd Couple. You know, it happened in The Star Spangled Girl after the girl comes to live with them. It happens in a reverse order with God's Favorite. Anyway, and for those of us who are just intrigued by seeing Jesse Eisenberg, who did such good work at Social Network, yeah, go see another side of him. It's really nice that he decided to write a play with this role in mind for himself. So, and he carries that off very well. But yeah, I wish the reason were better why the brother leaves off his new wife for a concerted period of time. That's quite a thing for a new husband to do, you know. So,
So
in a way, he's leading our suspicions to think something truly bad is going on, and he doesn't allow us to have as much benefit of the doubt as we might be inclined to have, given that cloudy, seemingly nefarious setup.
Well, absolutely. Another apparent point of the play, I just read an interview with Jesse Eisenberg, and I have to say he did several to promote this show, which I think is very admirable.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, I guess this is clear, and it is it's a very interesting subject. Another point of the play is supposed to be that here's someone who is a very intellectual person, but it's all, you know, basically from school and the internet and Google and whatever. And as far as life experience, he's just woefully inadequate. So he over intellectualizes everything, and he's just not, when it comes to actual like human relations and things like that, he's really not that good. And another point of it is the white guilt that he has. At one point, during the action of the play, he gets mugged off stage, and he comes back on, and he basically says, he rationalizes the whole thing about how underprivileged, you know, the muggers were and how bad their lives are. And at the end, he says something like, "I would have beaten me up too." So there are, you know, some very interesting things in it, very interesting characters. I'm surprised he didn't. It doesn't seem like it would have been too difficult to work on that, the whole thing about the brother leaving the wife with them, and make it somewhat more. But as you say, he could have just told them the reason, which as you say, is not that interesting anyway. At the beginning, I'm not sure why he did that, because I don't think the suspense of why she's there is the, well, I guess it is, because then he concocts the whole theory about her being, a sex slave. I think he could have worked on that a little bit more.
All righty. So I guess we'll move on to our next topic, which is relatively speaking. Peter, why don't you give us an overview on this three-hander?
three-one-act plays, which is something you don't get to see very much anymore. I have to say I'm amazed this got produced from an economic standpoint. There are so many people in it. Woody Allen's play, the third play of the night, has about 10 people in it, maybe more. And we're not talking about people who are making $1,653 a week, Broadway minimum. I mean, I can't believe that people like Julie Kavner and Mark Lynn Baker are getting minimum. Certainly not Marlo Thomas in the second play by Elaine May called George is Dead. And these are high-powered people. Lisa Emery. I mean, these are people whose agents must demand a good deal of money for their clients. So so this show makes no economic sense to me. Sadly, none of it is really very good. Now, the second play, George is Dead by Elaine May, I saw a couple of years ago at the George Street Playhouse in New Brunswick in a very different form. It was a two-act play then. Elaine May has simply dropped the first act of the play, and this is the second act. And I will admit that this play has something to say. This is about a very coddled woman who, as a young girl, had a nanny who was very attentive to her. And the implication of the play is, if you have a nanny and who's very attentive to your child, there's a good chance that child will grow up to be a child. And that's what Marlo Thomas is really playing. A grown-up child who needs everything done for her because she never learned how to do it herself. So when her husband suddenly dies, George is dead, now she doesn't know to whom to turn. And as a result, the first person she goes to is her nanny's daughter, hoping to find out where the nanny is because they've lost touch. And it's up to the nanny to make things right again, this 96-year-old woman, to make things right again. So I do think the play has a point, and I bought what it had to say. It's just one of those plays. It's funny. I saw Light Up the Sky recently, the Moss Hart play, and both I had the reaction to that one as well. They're just not as funny as you want them to be. You just expect that they're going to be substantially funnier because of the authors involved, that you're going to get zingers and one-liners that are going to be funny. But that has been left, ironically enough, to Woody Allen in his third in the third play of the night, in which we are dealing with a man and woman on their honeymoon. They go to this really tacky place. And there's all sorts of talk about, oh, when we get in bed, it's going to be great and all this kind of stuff. And you're thinking, wait a minute. I mean, you know, this is 2011. I mean, premarital intercourse has been going on for a long, long time. Are you telling me these two people haven't slept together yet and now they're married? Indeed. They have not slept together, and I don't believe they're quite married. There's a secret that's going to come out that does get a wonderful, amused gasp from the audience. But this really does come across as a second level Neil Simon play. It's very Neil Simon-ish in its construction and in its situation, and it doesn't do very much at all. The Ethan Coen play that begins the show has much more imagination than this one, than the Woody Allen one does, and it takes place in a prison where a guy who is supposedly there to help the mental patient has a much harder time than he thinks he's going to have, and there's a great deal of amusement in that one. But I will say this about the Woody Allen play: I don't want to give too much away, but it is very interesting that in recent years, how often he's written about an older man falling in love with a younger woman, which is a situation not unknown to Woody Allen himself. And he seems to like to write about that, and that happens in this play too. So I can't imagine this production is going to be with us very long. I saw a lot of walkouts the night I attended, and I would just think it's too expensive. And there has always been a tough time, you know, with unrelated one-act plays. Neil Simon has had success with one-act plays that at least have the same setting, you know, be it Plaza Suite, a California Suite, those ran, but at least that had that strange type of unity. These, you know, it's not only you assume three plays, you're going to get three sets. You actually get four sets. I mean, so it's not a cheap show. So I have a feeling by New Year's Eve they'll be celebrating one of their final performances. So not just because it doesn't make much economic sense, but I'm afraid the evening isn't as good as we want it to be.
All right, Michael, what'd you think?
And yet, the production received an inexplicably positive review from Charles Isherwood in the New York Times.
We all do that. Every one of us has one of these stories where we love something that nobody else does. So it's his turn for that. You know, good luck to him. Go on, Mike.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, but I mean, yes. I mean, I won't express my opinion of the review, but I'll just say that if I'm not going to urge anyone to go see this production, but if you do see it, please read or reread the Times review, and then you can decide how much stock you're going to put in Charles Isherwood's opinion in the future. This should not be on Broadway, and it would not be if these people weren't involved. I had such mixed feelings about Marlo Thomas because I thought she was so wonderful in it. She looks fantastic, but I kept saying, God, I wish she had picked something else to come back to Broadway. And because when was the last time she was on Broadway, Peter?
Was it that play Thieves back in 1974? That's what comes to mind. I think it was around then because she was running around with Herb Gardner at the time, who was the playwright. Ironically enough, I remember seeing it in Boston, the very first performance, and Valerie Harper was in it, and she left the play. I think that was the only performance she did, in fact. If not, she didn't do many more. And Marlo Thomas did her boyfriend a favor and came in and did it. I never saw her do it then. So, but I think that's it. I could be wrong.
Yeah, I mean, she may have done Love Letters somewhere, but that was
yeah,
Broadway
yeah,
anyway.
She did. Yeah, yeah.
I always say that whenever I wonder if someone, you know, has been, well, they probably did love letters.
Yeah, right. It's really almost as definite a thing to assume as that they've done Law and Order. I mean, it really is, you know, so I see your point.
But yeah, I felt that each of the plays had definitely had their moments, especially in terms of comedy, but basically all of them were a mess in one way or another. And it seems like there was a trouble during the preview period with, I believe, among other things, it was reported that Stanley Donen, who was married to Elaine May, came in and had a look at it. But the first one, for example, there's the main action is this talking cure, supposedly, between the doctor and the mental patient, and there are those scenes, but then and the short scenes with a series of blackouts, and then suddenly we switch and this whole other set comes on, as Peter alluded, with the parents of the flashback scene, the parents of the mental patient, and we supposedly see why he ended up the way he did. But then, oddly enough, at the end of that scene, there's a blackout, and the lights come up, and that play is over. And I don't know about when you went, Peter, but when I saw it, people were like looking. Well, should we applaud? Is that it?
Yeah.
Because it just seemed incredibly strange for the action not to go back to the doctor and the patient. So I don't know what that was all about. I almost felt like it did originally, and that was cut, like at the last minute. But that seemed very strange. The second play, George is Dead, started out very, very well, I thought. But then it just kind of really lost it. And it became very serious at the end. And although, again, Marlo Thomas did a great job with that, it didn't seem to work at all or fit in. I'm not sure. I had a discussion with the person I went with. It seems like that the roles are not necessarily well cast in terms of age, because when Marlo Thomas kept referring to her nanny, at first I thought she must have meant the nanny of her children. She meant her own nanny. But if that woman would be old enough to have been Marlo Thomas's nanny, then her daughter would probably have been considerably older than mm-hmm. what we see on stage here. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that works out at all. And I think that basically comes down to the fact that Marlo Thomas was miscast in terms of age. Although, again, I think she looks absolutely fantastic. And the third one, I just, you know, I found a lot of it incredibly distasteful. Not necessarily the main plot point, as Peter said, of the groom's father running off with the bride at the wedding, but there were other like little jokes, just really tasteless jokes, including one quote unquote joke about child sexual abuse. Did you notice that little joke there, Peter? I just don't think that that's something that we need to laugh at. And I was obviously, it really upset me. It will be interesting to see how long this thing lasts.
It will be interesting.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, just my experiences. As I said, I mean, there were times when the theater was just filled with laughter, because you don't necessarily see that kind of humor on Broadway anymore, for better or worse. But I think, I think there's nothing wrong with it when it's well done. But then there were, all these lines that just went over like, you know, lead balloons. And then the distasteful stuff and the confusing stuff and the tonal shifts and all of that. So I don't, maybe people will remember the funny parts and give, good word of mouth to their friends, or maybe the opposite. I don't know. It's interesting that you saw some walkouts, Peter.
Yeah, including somebody in my row who has a long association with Neil Simon, walked out even before the Neil Simon-ish Woody Allen play came, maybe out of respect for Neil Simon, I don't know. But what will be interesting, you know, now this is a chance where we're really going to get to see what the power of the times and the power of Charles Isherwood actually is. You know, will it be a case that that review will save his show? Because how many times I have... even with this one, I have talked to casual theater goers who have said, "Gee, I hear Relatively Speaking is really good. The reviews were good, you know, and the reviews plural were not good. The review was good,
right? Exactly.
But people, there are still theater goers who read the Times and assume that one size fits all. That if what the Times thought is what everybody else thought too. It's sad that that's the way people think, but that is the way they've been conditioned to think, either from others or by themselves. But so we will see what the power of a Charles Isherwood New York Times review is as a result of this. You know, so yeah. If it runs the season. If it runs the season, then we'll have learned something about because people are questioning reviews today, how much power they have, who's listening to who, the blogger thing, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, we will see. We will see what we shall see.
Of course, you still can't tell 100% because in this case, you know, the writers are all very famous and several of the cast members.
That's fair.
Did we mention, Steve Guttenberg, Julie Kavner? Mm-hmm. You know, Marlo Thomas. One can assume that that positive review was very helpful to them in terms of longevity of the run.
All righty. So the next show we're going to talk about quickly is The Irish Rep is doing a Dancing at Lunasa.
Lunasa.
And Peter and Michael and I were talking quickly before the we started recording about the anniversary that this represents.
Well, I mean, to some people this will not mean much, but for me, I was astonished to see that this is the 20th anniversary production of Dancing at Lunasa. And when I saw that, I said, well, all right, this must mean the original production that was done in Ireland, that it was 20 years ago. I mean, it can't be 20 years since the Broadway opening. Oh, yes, it is. Tempest does fugit, no question about it. And for better or worse, for those of us who have been following Broadway for a long time, it's very surprising to find out that 20 years have already passed since this play was on Broadway. This is a lovely production, and I recommend it highly, even if you've seen the play, even if you've seen the movie. It's really quite, quite nice, and it works very well on the very small Irish Rep stage. You know, I give Charlotte Moore a lot of credit. A lot of people would have looked at that space and said, uh-uh. we're not doing plays here. It's an L-shaped room. So you are off, there's a certain section that's off to the side. And the cramped nature of this theater really helps this play because it is about poor folk living in Ireland trying to make a living. And one of them's a teacher and doesn't much like it, and two of them work making handmade gloves. And part of the play involves the fact that, after all, the Industrial Revolution is coming, and these ladies are not going to be making a living making their gloves anymore because people can get them cheaper as a result of machines. That's only one facet of the play. It's really narrated by... A man looking back on his youth. The thing was that his mother had a child out of wedlock, and the man who impregnated her does show up from time to time. Not often enough, but he does show up from time to time. He doesn't even really want to deal with the child. You don't see any interaction with him and the child. And this boy grows up only knowing his father is a shadowy figure who comes around, and he really, you know, stays in the background while his father's there. And the writing is so wonderful because you can really tell that the woman still loves this man, even though, you know, she really shouldn't. It's very potent. Every sister has an agenda of one form or another. There's the shy sister who wants to fall in love, and her sisters are very fearful, and it makes sense because look what happened to the sister with this other guy. The stern sister. What was fascinating about the original production was, granted, it was a bad year for choreography. And when the Tony nominations came out, Dancing at Lunasa, a play, got a Best Choreography nomination, because there is a scene in the play when suddenly they start talking about dancing and dancing takes over. There's a lot of talk about dancing. There's more talk about dancing in this show than there is in Bob Fosse's dancing. But there is a scene when the sisters let go and dance, even the one who was the sternest. Before this scene happens, there's even talk about, let's go to the dance on Friday night. And the oldest said, no, we cannot. We're too old for that. You know, this. What will people think? There's a lot of what will people think in this play, a lot of it. You know, how will we hold our heads up from now on? That comes up. That line is used more than once. And what's so fascinating is that the sister who is the most stern about, we're not dancing, that's it, when finally the dancing does take over with the radio on, the sister who is the most stern is the one who's the best dancer. She's amazing to see on stage, to see her really doing steps. I mean, I cannot believe that she did not know Irish dancing before she did this play. And if she didn't, then she is utterly remarkable at being a quick learner, because what she does is mesmerizing. But so's the play. What's really nice, too, in the second act, hasn't been going on very long, and suddenly the grown boy comes out and tells us what happened to everybody. And we say, oh, all right, you know, that's the end of the play. Gee, that's surprising. Why they even bother having an intermission? No, there will be scenes to follow. And we don't usually get that. Usually when a person wraps up what happened to the characters, that's the end of the show. But there's far more to come. And once you know what happens to these people and then see a scene that's in essence a flashback, it resonates even more, because you know what happens to these people and they don't know yet. So even that's very smart. Brian Friel's Dancing at Lunasa, I recommend it very highly.
So if you would like to go see the Irish Repertory Theatre's production of this, we have a link on BroadwayRadio.com where you can link over to it and buy your tickets to it. It's running through December 11th, and so it's kind of a nice little run there. How big is the theater that it's in, Peter?
I doubt if it's 200 seats. I'd be surprised if it was that many. I think it only had, let's see, I would say it has about 9 rows in the big section, about 5 in the other, maybe even 4. So it's a very intimate experience, and if it's not quite stadium seating, it's more on the line of stadium seating than most conventional theaters. So the sight line is very good if you're in the main section. I once wrote a review about the fact that I had seen a play there that I felt did not play to the side section at all, and I really chastised the director. And the next time I went to Irish Rep, I was put in that section. I wonder if, you know, if they were purposely saying to me, look, it's better than you think being in that section. And, you know, it was. And that was for the Emperor Jones. And I was very surprised. And again, different director. And, you know, but I really had to doubt my earlier statement that if you're in the side there, you're not going to see as good a show. And so I'm not as sure of that as I was before. So, but I'll tell you, for this one, I would have sat there and been very, very happy, because it really is such a terrific production of a terrific play.
In a moment, I'm sorry, Michael, what were you going to say?
Yeah, I was going to say, I've never sat on that side. I think they don't tend to place critics and journalists there, which in itself is a comment that maybe they feel that the seats are not as good as the other section. But as you say, Peter, it really depends on the play and the director.
Sure.
I can't wait to see this there. I'm a little surprised that they haven't done it before, but maybe one reason they didn't was because they were a little intimidated, you know, just a little worried about putting so relatively large a show on that stage, and also staging it properly in terms of sight lines. So bravo to them for, you know, waiting and then apparently doing it right. It's such a wonderful play. I could see it coming across even better there than it did on Broadway, just because of the increased intimacy.
Yeah. Indeed. Yeah.
All right, the last show we're going to talk about is The Atmosphere of Memory, which is playing down at the Bank Street Theater with Ellen Burstyn. But before we do that, I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayStars.com, and on the right-hand side, there's a Broadway Radio section. In that section right there, there's a subscribe button. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you, so you won't miss it. If you want to listen to us any other way, you can listen to us in the Zune Marketplace. You can listen to us on Android through the Google's Listen application. You can listen to us on a BlackBerry or almost any other device through Stitcher, which is an application for lots of devices. You can download and listen to us on the fly so you don't have to sync. You can also listen to us on Broadway World Radio, Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. As I mentioned before, if you go to BroadwayRadio.com, you can see all of our show notes, which are links to various things that we've talked about today and contact information for Peter, Michael, and myself. You can follow us on Facebook, on Twitter, phone numbers, all sorts of things there, as well as email addresses. So Michael got a chance to go down and see The Atmosphere of Memory. Why don't you tell us about that?
Well, I can't tell you too much about it because it hasn't opened yet, but I will say... and I hate to end on a sad negative note, but this venue where the play is being done, the Bank Street Theater, I've seen shows there before, but I don't know. I guess it must have been completely reconfigured or something, because this was one of the worst experiences I've ever had in terms of just the venue, in terms of the sight lines and audience amenities. The audience is on three sides, which, you know, is not a problem in itself, but there were these huge, not even posts. I mean, there's like tremendously huge columns, you know, supporting the roof above you, that terribly hindered the sight lines. And also an issue is the fact that the stage floor is not raised at all, the playing space, so that even though the audience sections are raked considerably, you have a problem in seeing the lower portions of people's bodies, or in seeing people at all when they're, if they're seated or lying down on a couch, which is the case in several places in this show. And then on top of that, you have to actually leave the building and go across the courtyard in order to go to the restroom. So I was very, very unhappily surprised to see that. And apparently I spoke to one of the staff members and I said, this isn't the permanent home of the Labyrinth Theater Company now, is it? And he said, well, yes, actually it is. They didn't seem to think that there was anything that wrong with it, but I was surprised. I mean, that's a very well-regarded, well-established off-Broadway theater. The artistic directors are Stephen Adley Gerges, Mimi O'Donnell, and Yul Vasquez. The board of directors includes Philip Seymour Hoffman, who's done a lot of work for them, John Ortiz. Sad that people like that can't find a better venue, but that goes along with you know, what Peter said before about Broadway theaters. We've lost, I think, maybe even more off-Broadway theaters in recent years. And it's a real problem. And I think it's unfortunate that the Labyrinth can't find something better. Coincidentally, I noticed while going down there, we walked past the Actors Playhouse, and which I believe is completely vacant now. And that has its own issues. But if it were refurbished, I think it's basically a very good space. So I don't know, maybe that'll happen, and maybe somebody will move in there. Maybe Labyrinth can move in there instead of this.
That would be a nice space for Labyrinth. In fact, the Actors Playhouse was refurbished, at least with seats, and the seats that they put in not that long ago are very comfortable, and certainly an improvement over what had been there. But that's a quintessential example, Michael, of what you're talking about how off-Broadway spaces are disappearing, because that was really a place that people used to go quite a bit during the 60s and 70s.
On a positive
ironically
note,
enough, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. Just on a positive note, the Cherry Lane almost closed for good.
Sure.
And then for whatever reason, thank God, fortunately, it didn't. And that's a very nice space where.
And it's a lovely street too. There's something about walking down that street and that little turn in the road there that happens. Yeah. I mean, I just love being there.
Yeah.
It was one of the first off-Broadway theaters I ever went to in 1967. So I have great affection for the space, and I'm very glad that Cherry Lane is still with us. But yeah, there are so many that have disappeared and have become co-ops. Losing the Promenade on Broadway in the 70s was meaning the blocks, not the era, was really a sad one. Losing the Perry Street Theater, which was a very nice small space, was sad too. So we got a million of them that we've lost, and because there's no question the real estate can be used for other more profitable ventures. So it's too bad.
Okay, so I guess that wraps it up for right now. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radios This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye, buddy.
Bye.
I've got a wife, and I'm singing. And we did a special kind of hug I'd never heard about before. When it was over, I was singing. And now we've got a kid, so I'm singing.
Buddy, wake the baby.
It's okay, Papa Hops. The baby loves Buddy singing.
All I have to do is sing to stop a string of sleepy sobs. 'Cause nobody likes a Christmas song like little Buddy Hobbs. And that's why his middle name just happens to be Sparkle Jolly Twinkle Jingle Leaf.
Now spend each Christmas here dressed up in North Pole festive wear.
And my son has Jovi's eyes
and Buddy's bright red curly hair.
But you'll find that Buddy Jr. takes after me. I'm Sparkle Jolly Twinkle Jingly.
No, you're not.
Yes, I am.
No, you're not.
Yes, I am.
No, you're not.
Yes, I am.
And when the baby's grown, he'll ride on Mike's sleigh and he'll deliver gifts galore.
We'll teach him Christmas never gets him away.
Guess who's at the front door?